In April, you took over as chairman of the Radio and Television News Directors Association. Does that process work along the same lines as American Idol?
Actually, no. Though after my year as chairman, you can ask other members of our board and other members of our association if they would have been better served had they gone through a process like that.
Well, you're not
no, it doesn't work that way at all. It chairmen or chairwomen of RTNDA are generally members of the board of directors, and there are two kinds of board of two kinds of directors. The first is regional directors. There are 13 regions around the country, geographical regions. Each of those regions has a representative on our board of directors. And there are also directors at large who are elected by the membership as a whole to be general representatives of the industry's interests on the board. And we also have one permanent board member representing RTNDA Canada, and we have one board member representing international members of RTNDA. That can be Canada, or this person can be from one of any of the more than 30 countries in which we have members.
Well, it sounds like a fun process. Maybe not American Idol fun, but still. You know, I can't remember a time, it seems to me, when radio and television faced greater challenges or opportunities, perhaps. Do you have some favorite challenges that you foresee dealing with in the next year?
Oh, I do. And in my speech upon assuming the chairmanship at our international conference and exhibition in Las Vegas, RTNDA at NAB, in April of 2005, I laid out the five biggest challenges that I foresee for our industry and our association. Would you like me to detail them now?
Only five? Well, yeah, oh, I'd love to. Yeah.
Well, they're five, but they're big and they're complicated.
Yeah, I'd love to hear those.
The first, and in my opinion, and I'm speaking just for myself when I say this, the biggest challenge we face is what I call the credibility crisis. It's become increasingly clear to me. And I should put a footnote here that not everyone agrees with this assessment, and I understand and respect that. But it's become increasingly clear to me that fewer people, fewer news consumers from across the ideological spectrum believe what we tell them anymore. And after I outlined this challenge in my speech, a couple of weeks later, University of Missouri School of Journalism's Center for Advanced Social Research released a new nationwide study showing that 85% of those questioned around the country believed that news reports were biased. I think it was 40% thought it was a liberal bias, 30% a conservative bias, 12% thought that they detected biases from in both respects in news reports they consumed. Regardless of whether we as journalists feel, regardless how much we feel and how hard we work to try to make our reports fair and balanced, no matter how hard we try to remove whatever biases may exist in our work, the public just doesn't believe that we are fair, generally speaking. So we've got to find a way to address this issue. You know, it used to be, years ago, that we could just sit in our newsrooms and ignore our critics because we knew they had to get their information from us. I'm not saying we made a conscious effort as an industry to do that, but that's human nature, and it tended to occur, in my opinion. But we can't do that anymore because there's a plethora of places people can go to get their news and information. And if they don't think we're being fair, and if they don't believe what we're telling them, then they'll go somewhere else. So we've got to address this, and I think the first step is to conduct as an industry some meaningful introspection. And only through that process, taking a hard look at what we do and how we do it and what our processes are as individual newsrooms around the country and around the world to address this issue, then I don't think it's going to get fixed. We've got to plant new seeds of trust with the news-consuming public. And I will tell you that that same University of Missouri School of Journalism survey that showed 85% think we're biased, that same survey provided us with the fertile ground we need to plant those seeds of trust. And that is, the same survey also showed, by a 3-to-1 margin, and I'm paraphrasing here, the public believed that journalism is still generally a force for good, and journalism plays a vital role in their lives. So what that tells me is that despite concerns about our perceived biases, there still is a lot of goodwill out there among those whom we attempt to serve every day by as we cover the news. So we've got to take advantage of that before that goes away. I also think that RTNDA has been a leader in the past in the effort to instill trust with the public, and it can now serve as an entity to nourish those seeds of trust we have to plant in this fertile ground. I mean, the RTNDA Code of Ethics is the industry standard. It's used in newsrooms and classrooms around the world. There's a series of RTNDA coverage guidelines where we do address the ethical issues and dilemmas involved in making tough decisions on a daily coverage basis. The most recent expanded set of guidelines we released in April of 2005 was on this VNR issue, the video news release issue. So we don't, I used the term industry standards a second ago, we don't set standards for newsrooms. Journalists have to make their own decisions. There can be, and really should be, no central authority for determining what news coverage is or should be. That flies in the face of the First Amendment and freedom of the press and all those principles that I think everyone holds dear. These coverage guidelines do provide a foundation on which electronic journalists can make these critical decisions about how to proceed and how to gain or regain or keep the public's trust. So RTNDA is uniquely positioned to lead this discussion. And I think it's a discussion and some meaningful introspection that we need to have. So that's the first issue.
Assuming you whip credibility and move on to your second item, I can't wait. What is it?
Yeah, the second item I call the new news economy. You know, there was a moment circa the early 1980s when owners and general managers walked into radio and television newsrooms or met with the news directors all around the country and said, you know what? We got to start making money from this news product. And those of us who were around back then all sort of recoiled in horror because we were about journalism. We were about something much more important than profit. And so we recoiled in horror at that, and it took there was quite a period of adjustment that, to some degree anyway, is still going on in the industry. That paradigm still exists, clearly, but that is the old news economy now. In the new news economy, because of advances in information technology, consumers have all the power. And you notice I keep referring to them as consumers. They have all the power. If they are empowered and emboldened by iPods, satellite radio, the blogosphere, the internet in general, and other PDAs, pagers, cell phones. Those technological advances have allowed consumers to gain all of the power. There are plenty of places where they can go to get the information they need to lead productive lives. If we, the established traditional electronic journalism industry, doesn't adapt to that, if we don't recognize that these advances in information technologies have rendered our traditional information delivery methods increasingly irrelevant, then we're going to be left behind. You know, there will be a day, and it will be fairly soon. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next week or next year, but soon, sooner than we think, there will be a day when radio, television, and newspapers will be viewed as quaint relics of the past. Electronic journalism will someday be known merely as audio and video delivered on platforms that we may not even be able to conceive of at this moment. So,
is this a notion that other members of the association buy into?
I don't presume that everyone will completely agree with what I say on this issue or the credibility crisis or other issues I may raise, but I respect that. I understand that and I respect that. What I hope to accomplish here is to start a process, start a conversation, start a discussion about how we in electronic journalism, who I believe are uniquely positioned and qualified to thrive in this new information technology world, we're uniquely positioned to thrive in that world. We're the professionals. We're the people who know how to go out and get the information and know how to tell compelling stories to the public that make stories that make differences in people's lives. All we have to do to conquer this is open ourselves up to the idea that we've got to deliver our information in different ways. You know, I tell electronic journalists, you know, think of it this way. Which is more important, the compelling, important story you tell, or the radio, television, or newspaper on which that compelling story presently exists? Clearly, the story is more important. The content is more important than how it's delivered. So we've got to figure out new, more, and better ways to deliver that content. So that's the second issue. The third issue is what I call government persecution. There is no reason to believe that the government's prosecutorial persecution of journalists will ease anytime soon. At our April 2005 convention, we were honored to have and honored to honor a guy named Jim Terracani, who is an investigative reporter for WJAR-TV in Providence, Rhode Island. Terracani was sentenced to 6 months house arrest by a federal judge in Providence for the unspeakable crime of refusing to reveal the identity of a confidential source. After 4 months of his six-month home detention sentence, he was granted early release. Like a week before our convention. So we made arrangements to fly him out to our convention in Las Vegas. We gave him an award for standing up for his principles and making sacrifices in the responsible pursuit of the truth. We also gave an honor to his news director, Betty Jo Cugini, who stood behind him and supported him in every way possible. Jim Terracani is one of a growing number of poster children for the potential trouble that we'll get into if journalists are thrown in jail for doing their jobs. More than 30 states have shield laws that allows reporters to conceal the identity of confidential sources. The federal government does not have one. RTNDA is among the leaders in the effort to push for a federal shield law. If you don't have a shield law, and if reporters know they can go to jail for not revealing the identity of confidential sources, guess what? It's human nature. Fewer reporters will do investigative reports in which they need to use confidential sources. Fewer whistleblowers, for fear their identity will be released under threat of a federal judge, fewer whistleblowers will come forward. The public will not be as well served as possible by journalists if we don't have a federal shield law. That's the third issue. Fourth issue is what I call government manipulation. And I mentioned VNRs, video news releases, earlier. We knew more than a year ago, in early 2004, that the federal government had used taxpayer dollars to produce video news releases disguised as legitimate news stories to hawk their Medicare reform plan. We learned in early 2005 that the government had also paid huge sums of money to newspaper columnists, to a prominent cable TV commentator / radio talk show host to push its education reforms. We can't stop, RTNDA can't stop any administration, whether they're Republican or Democrat, from using this tactic. But what we can do is call attention to it. And what we can do is establish suggested guidelines for the industry and that essentially help them figure out how to avoid participating in the ruse. We have done that. We will keep doing that whenever necessary. And the fifth big issue is diversity. You know, we in this industry talk a very good game about how our products, our news products, need to reflect our communities. But the sad fact is that the number of journalists of color, the number of openly gay and lesbian journalists, the number of journalists who have ideological points of view different from the norm that's prevalent in many newsrooms, those numbers are woefully inadequate. Here's another area where I believe RTNDA is uniquely positioned to be able to make a difference in this area. I know for a fact, because I have met dozens and dozens of them, there are journalists of color who are working extremely hard. They're desperate to get into this business. The disconnect comes in finding newsrooms where they will be nurtured in communities where they will feel welcome. There's a gap there that I believe RTNDA can help bridge, and that's another project we'll be working on during the coming year. You know, just before I took over as chairman, I was interviewed by a reporter, and I laid out these goals, and at the end of the conversation, the reporter said, "My God, that's a lot. How do you ever hope to accomplish all of that?" And my answer was, you know, I don't think I will accomplish all of that to everyone's satisfaction, but at least I think it's important to raise these issues. It's important to start a discussion, start a dialogue, start a debate if necessary. So at least we're thinking about ways we can address these, and that will give us a very important leg up as we move into the future.
I'd like to go back to something you touched on earlier. According to a recent report by the Pew Internet and American Life Project, 32 million American adults, which is about 1 in 6, read blogs.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a blogger?
Yeah, I don't blog myself, but I am a voracious consumer of information on blogs.
Any plans to be a blogger?
I've thought about it. My issue is, you know, where would I find the time? I have two full-time jobs right now, one running my own newsroom and the other as chairman of RTNDA.
Does RTNDA have a blog?
Not yet. One of the things I have done, though, is I've appointed a blue ribbon task force made up of former chairman and experts in the new media industry to recommend ways that RTNDA can fully integrate new media journalism concerns into all of our activities and all of our curricula. One of those issues, one of the ways I anticipate we will perform that integration is by encouraging blogs.
Do you have a couple of favorites you could share with us, or would you rather not do that?
I'd rather not do that. Okay. I will tell you this. I do read blogs. I read political blogs from both ends of the ideological spectrum. One of the ways I keep up with what's happening in my hometown of Springfield, Missouri, is by reading blogs that are done by people in Springfield. I read a couple of entertainment blogs, a couple of journalism-oriented blogs. I probably read at least a dozen blogs pretty much every day.
Are bloggers journalists? Can they be?
Well, whether a blogger is a journalist or not depends on the nature of the blog. Whether a blogger is a citizen journalist is up to that blogger. I mean, who am I or who is anyone to say that someone who is a citizen journalist is not a real journalist? You know, if they're doing some reporting, if they're uncovering facts and sharing them with the public, then under the loosest definition of the term, they are journalists. Whether or not they are formal quote-unquote journalists, one thing is for sure, they're making a difference, and they're going to make a greater difference. The power of the blogosphere, it seems to me, is that it empowers people and emboldens them to participate in the process of disseminating information. I do disagree with my respected colleagues, some of whom say that, well, bloggers, you know, what was the famous quote? They're, you know, sitting around in their pajamas in front of their TV sets just spewing facts with no regard as to whether they're true. If a blogger posts something that's not true, that posting will instantly be fact-checked by dozens, if not hundreds or thousands, of other bloggers or others who are on the Internet who will, you know, post back to that blog, no, that was wrong, here's the thing. I disagree with that, but I think they're a very important part of the process that we in traditional journalism have to pay attention to.
Do you own an iPod or some other brand of MP3 player?
I do have an MP3 player.
How do you use it?
I use it for my job. If I'm trying to hire an anchor or a reporter, oftentimes I will take the emailed air check that they'll send to me, and I'll download it into my MP3 player, and I'll use that to listen to air checks, use it to listen to music. I have used it to listen to newscasts. You know, there are some groundbreaking radio stations around the country that are podcasting their news product, and I take advantage of that whenever possible.
Well, you anticipated my next question. Obviously, you've been following the podcasting phenomenon. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's terrific, because the more non-traditional ways we can think of to deliver our product, the better we serve the public.
Can you explain why anybody in their right mind would pay for cable when television is free? Hang on, wait. That's from an earlier interview. The question I meant to ask was why anybody would pay for satellite radio when they can get it for free?
My sense of that is that, you know, if they're going to pay for it, they must feel like there's a need that isn't being met by free over-the-air radio. But here again, I think it's news and information and connection with local communities that will allow terrestrial radio to survive the satellite radio craze.
Is it a craze?
When I say craze, I don't mean to diminish it in any way. It's a very important force, and it's probably going to get much more important and meaningful and influential. But you know, again, if I'm driving down the freeway in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I live, and I see a huge plume of smoke up ahead, you know, I'm not going to be able to punch up a satellite radio station and find out what it is. I'm going to punch up the local news talk station, the local news station, the favorite morning show that I have, and they're going to be able to tell me, and they will tell me. And those of us who are providing that information have to tell listeners those sorts of things. In other words, and the plume of smoke I say that metaphorically. We have to be in touch with our communities, know what's going on around us, and disseminate that specific information to our listeners. And that's how we build a fortress around our products so that satellite radio can't encroach.
Some have suggested that maybe the popularity and the growth of satellite radio might serve as a wake-up call to some of the owners who gutted their newsrooms over the last however many years, and they might realize that they really have to be local, and to do that, they're going to need people and reporters. Any hope of that in your mind?
I don't know where that trend is going to go. Clearly, they'll need people if they're going to be in touch with their communities and provide critical local information. Clearly, they have to do that. But I've always believed that for some, and I've told aspiring young journalists this for years, people who have a willingness to work hard, have a willingness to pay a few dues as they get into things, have some talent, have some ability, and they're good at what they do, people like that will always be able to find well-paying jobs in this industry. Those jobs do exist, and people who are driven and talented and willing to do the work and make the investment, they will always succeed. There'll always be jobs for those people.
Yeah, I agree. Before I leave the satellite radio thing, do you subscribe to satellite radio?
Yes.
Again, you probably don't want to tell us which flavor you have.
No. And frankly, the reason I do it is because I want to hear what they're up to, and I want to hear what they're offering.
Absolutely.
So that I can, attempt to influence the product on the radio station where I work, so that we can always make sure that satellite radio doesn't become a threat to us.
The Associated Press recently announced that they're going to begin charging members for using AP material on member websites in addition to the existing dues they're already paying. Had you budgeted for that at WTMJ?
No.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think, on one hand, as a consumer of the AP product, I like most AP members, I probably feel like I'm paying too much. Nobody likes to pay more. But on the other hand, I do understand the big picture here, which is if these information technologies these new information technologies are going to thrive, the people who run them have to figure out how to monetize them. And so from a free enterprise point of view and as a supporter of new media, I hope they make a go of it. As a consumer of that product, I'm not thrilled because I never like paying more for anything.
Well, I know you're awfully busy, Dan, and I've taken a half-hour chunk out of your day already.
Has it been that long?
Yeah. This is, and I got a zillion other questions, but I'll save them for another time. Are there any other topics that or things in this realm that we've been talking about that I haven't thought to ask that's near and dear to your heart or on the top of your mind?
No, I laid out my five big issues, and I think those five issues, that's enough to keep us busy for 10 years, let alone the 1 year that I'll be serving as chairman. But I think they're very important, and I feel very strongly about them. I don't presume to have the answers, but I am going to presume to try to use whatever bully pulpit I may have as RTNDA chairman to get conversations going about them, so that we can find solutions and can learn to thrive in this new environment.
Is this your first blog-only interview that you're aware of?
Yes.
Huh.
You're the first one.
Good. And what a great person to get to talk with me for the first. Is there anything you want to ask me?
How do you find time to blog?
Late at night, and weekends, and it's hard. I can't imagine. I have a lot more discretionary time than you do, but I would encourage you, either you individually or somebody at the top of RTNDA, which would be you now, to find time to actually get some hands on and blog that. You know, I'd heard about your speech and your five challenges, and I went out looking for that, and I was disappointed that I didn't find the audio, an MP3 file of your speech or some of the other keynote addresses from RTNDA.
Well, give me some time. That's precisely the kind of thing I feel we as an association have to do if we're going to be a leader in the effort to encourage others to do that sort of thing.
What I'd really love to do is, at the end of your term, do this again, and things are moving so fast now, it'll be fun to look back and see how much different or similar things are.
Sure. Happy to do it.